All right, so first an announcement. This is William Peters, who many of you know. He originated and runs the Shared Crossing Project in Santa Barbara. And he has some flyers on the table if you want to take one, and an announcement about some things that the Shared Crossing Project is doing.
Thanks, Spencer. Good to see you all. I remember I was here, I think, last March giving a talk. So it's always good to be with you guys. I'm here because I have a couple events, but one in particular. Dr. Monica Murphy, who's the leading ER voice for conscious end of life on the medical side, I dare say, in the country right now. She is one of the few ER doctors who's willing to ask, when is it okay to die? And she's really doing this from inside the medical establishment, and she's on sabbatical now. I'll tell you a little bit about that, but she was really the most sought after doctor in the country on these questions about, really, when do we, as each of us, when can we say enough is enough? We can, and so she'll engage us in a 3-hour workshop, which will be November the 6th.
Sorry, what's her name?
Her name is Dr. Monica Murphy. Dr. Monica Williams Murphy, officially. So, and then she's actually coming out for this program, which is our Shared Crossing Pathway program. And this is how I got her, because she feels, quite frankly, that our program is one of the most progressive in bringing about a conscious, connected, and loving end of life experiences. And so we're offering this program on November 3rd, 4th, and 5th. It's a weekend intensive. Fly over there. You'll meet Dr. Murphy at that. And those are my announcements. Thank you, Spencer. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all. Yes, question.
Where is it going to be located?
So we do all of our programs at 2020 Chapala. And if you've been there, it's the McDermott Crockett Mortuary. It's the second.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful building. It's the old St. Mark's Church. And it's the second oldest church structure in Santa Barbara. So that's what we do then. We don't do any hiding about what we're about here. So. And if you need financial assistance, please just inquire and we'll do the best we can. Because we know that, you know, these programs cost something to run, but we want to make it possible for those who are interested to attend. Thank you all. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That building is exquisite, 2020 Chapala. You've got to go, and you probably will notice it if you've ever been by it, because it's just a gem.
Okay, so a little bit about mindfulness, and we'll sit. We have much to cover today.
So something that just occurred to me a little while ago that I want to mention, I don't know how it's going to segue into the thing that I was going to tell you before. So anyway, this may or may not fit together. What I was thinking about was what Freud said when he was asked about what successful therapy should do. And he said, where id was, there shall ego be. Anybody hear that? Where id was, there shall ego be. That's what he considered the end of a successful psychotherapy. What that means is, in place of unconscious motivations, the id, there is a conscious sense of self. And I thought, that's exactly what mindfulness is. You know, it's bringing consciousness to that which motivates us, governs us, but that we're not aware of. So when we become aware of that stuff, we can cooperate with it, you know, our basic biological drives, and we can also move those things in the best direction. So what mindfulness is practice in becoming more self-aware, so that one is less unconsciously motivated to behave sometimes badly. The reason that I'm hesitating about this and the next thing is because that sounds like you get more self, because now you're more self-aware. But actually, there's less self, because the self that you weren't aware of, in Freud's view, 6/7 of your mind is underneath the surface of your awareness, and it's governing the tip of the iceberg that you're aware of. So now you're aware of a lot more of yourself, But because you're more self-aware, you're less governed by unconscious patterns. So actually what happens when you become more mindful is you become more self-familiar, but you become less self-dense. You kind of look at, you see yourself more clearly and you look through yourself better. And that's what eventually happens to these people that we consider to be great people, is the sense of self has thinned or expanded so that they're less self-concerned and more focused on you and larger things. So as you become more self-aware, you become, this dense self becomes more conscious and then more translucent and then eventually transparent, which is what I wanted to talk about, because we're going to talk about relationship today. So the question is, how does sitting with your eyes closed make you a better relating human being? You know, wouldn't doesn't this seem like a solipsistic pursuit of just, you know, paying attention to yourself? Well, it turns out that because you are more able to pay attention, you can not only pay more attention to yourself when you do so, you can also pay more attention to other people. So a mindful person listening to you is not off in their own head. A mindful person listening to you is present with awareness on you. Right? So there's better connection. Also, because you have seen all these patterns in yourself, you're much more understanding of other people, because you realize that they are governed by these same patterns that you're governed by, and that unfortunately, many people are not very self-aware, so they don't even know they're governed by these patterns. So you not only understand them better, you also have more compassion for them. Because you see, I mean, so often I see when I talk to people, as anybody, you know, that they're so in their head, and the problem that they're plagued by is this big problem in their head. It's not that somebody's actually sticking with pins or something. It's like they're... And I keep trying to kind of subtly say, look at that tree. Look at how beautiful that tree is. Breathe for a minute. You know, you're right here, right now. That's a thought, you know? And then right back into the, you know. So there comes more compassion for the things that people are caught in and don't know the way out of. Also, there's just more, because you're doing less selfing, unconsciously projecting a me between you and the world, because that's lessened, there's more sense of connection, of interbeing. That's what Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, right? It says interbeing. It says it's not like you're a separate person. It's like we're all kind of part of the same thing, and we're all just kind of like different bumps in the same fabric. So as you become more mindful, that is more aware, you become more aware of how connected we all are. And you become more understanding of those areas in the connected fabric that are experiencing stress. So that's kind of a complicated way of saying, by becoming more aware, you become more aware of yourself, you become more aware of other people, you become more aware of the unity of the whole thing. So it's really true that the kind of the more conscious people become, the better they behave, typically. Yeah. So if you don't want to talk about mindfulness, let's talk about any way that people become more conscious. As they become more conscious, they become more self-aware, they become more responsible, they have more self-control, and they have more concern for others. And that's what we're all trying to do, right? Is to be better individuals and better parts of the whole thing. Whatever it is, y'all. Okay, so having said all that, why don't we sit for 10 minutes and do our practice? Otherwise, we're just kind of like lost in the thought bubble again. What are we going to do? Can I just leave it like that? Is that okay?
Yes.
Or do you want me to pull it? Yeah? Okay. I can do that. Thank you.
be like that.
All right. So in these 10 minutes, your job is to notice everything and be preoccupied by nothing. Oh, one more thing about judgment, which is, if possible, don't judge. If you do judge, notice that you're judging and don't judge that. And, as you become better at not judging yourself, you'll become better at not judging other people too, and that will make them feel less judged and therefore more open and therefore more connected to you.
Can you read aloud for the week?
Say again?
Can you read aloud for the week?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Hey, Robert?
So a few announcements that I forgot to make
at the beginning.
First, life stories. Is Donna here?
She's in India.
India. Okay, so if you want to make a contribution to the Life Stories book, give Robert
what?
Email Robert. Robert at swt.org. Whatever you would like to put in the book, and we'll put it in the book. Okay, Robert@swt.org. And that can be anything. It can be an anecdote from your life. It can be a poem that you wrote. There's something in the book. Second, the art fair is the last class, which I think is the 17th.
Yeah.
We miss one class.
For Veterans Day.
For Veterans Day. So we do have next week's class, but then we miss a class, and then we come back for the 17th for the last.
And what about, you didn't talk about next quarter?
Not yet, but I will.
Well.
You email a reminder that there's no class. Some people may not.
I could probably do that.
Okay, email me right there.
So, when we talk about the next quarter.
I'm going to do it in a minute. Wait, let me do this. Okay. So, email about 11:10 and 11:17. Okay. Okay.
The art fair is on the 17th, so please do bring your artwork. Next quarter, next semester. The cat's out of the bag. I was going to tell you at the last class, but some of you were at Jack Canfield, so you heard this. Next semester, this class is free. Remember Free Adult Ed?
Yes!
It never went away, it just went into hiding. So it turns out that the state, I don't understand this entirely well, so I'll tell you what I do know. Turns out that the state still funds some things that we thought it wasn't going to fund. It doesn't fund life enrichment classes. So if you're going to take an art class, I think that you're still going to have to pay for the arts and crafts. But for other stuff like GED, preparing for various trades, I think ESL, it does fund, and one of the categories that it does fund is classes for the older adult. So I objected vociferously. I said it was for the mature adult, but they didn't. So the point is, this class, and so this class, because we were funded in the 5 years ago, we can be funded again. If a new class is proposed, it takes 18 months to 2 years. I would really like to call this class Adventures in Aliveness. I think it's a great name, but it'll take 2 years before they grind that through. So meanwhile, we rummaged through the archives, and we found that we ran a class 5 years ago called Consciousness, Science, and the Nature of Being. And that was because they didn't like spirituality, so it used to be called Consciousness, Science, and Spirituality, and we had to get rid of that, so we called it the Nature of Being. In any event, it's going to be called Consciousness, Science, and the Nature of Being for the Older Adult. Oh,
so where does it start, older?
What? And it will be, okay, so it will be 10 sessions, and it won't start in January. I think it starts about the beginning of March and goes through mid-May. They have to do it in two phases.
What does that mean? Two phases.
It meant that they couldn't all fit into the earlier time slot or the later time slot. So in any event, it straddles spring break. So Carl,
I think they split the semester in half. You can teach
or the second half. And so I guess I'm teaching half of the first half and half of the second half. I'm in the middle. Okay. So anyway, that's the deal.
It starts in March, not in January?
I think it starts the very beginning of March. I'll know next week. I'll come with the actual dates next week.
You want to know next week?
Yeah, I will. Okay. So I have to write that down, so. Dates.
And what age do they consider
Oh, it's, you can bring anybody you like. It doesn't matter. It's just the title of the class. You don't have to be of a particular age to take class. Okay. All right. So let's. Okay. So Morty.
Is there a big difference between the end of this class and then not again for March?
Will there be what?
There's a big hiatus.
Yes, there's a big hiatus. I don't know what you're going to do in that. What? Yeah, you go to Carl's class.
Yeah.
Carl, are you doing class starting in January?
February and March.
Oh.
Where at?
Say about it.
There are two week classes on aging and brain and aging, and they'll be over at the Wake Center.
Is it free?
Nope.
We
will have to call it for older adults. It'll take you 2 years to get it.
That'll take you 2 years, but yeah. Okay, so let's go to our, I want to cover a lot of ground today, and I want to show you a really good video at the end, so let's see how efficient we can be. And whatever I don't get to do this semester, I'll get to do next semester. I'm not going to throw anything away. Okay, so where we are with our consideration of the seven building blocks of well-being, okay, is, remember the acronym I spawned? High School Opera, HS Opera. Okay. So we've been through H, which is health, okay, S, which is security, as in financial, and also being safe from inimical influences in the environment, that is, things that are going to eat you. So HS, we've been through, and O is optimism, thinking in a realistically positive way as opposed to an unrealistically negative way. P, pleasure, because except for the unnatural pleasures which human beings have cooked up, in nature, pleasure signifies that which is life-promoting. And so, in general, if you have pleasure in your life, it shows that you're getting your needs met. And if you don't have pleasure, it shows you're not getting your needs met. So, pleasure, yeah.
Just a quick, I heard on NPR, and they played a woman from TED Talks, a scientist who researched the connection between play and compassion.
Compassion?
Yes, how play develops compassion. So anyway, it's tied to pleasure, you know, and I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, play, it turns out that play, you see play in a lot of animal species. Animals play. Why do they play? Because it connects them to others, and so that's part
and
of the
trust,
capacity.
Develops trust.
And it also develops the things that they will need in their life. That is, young animals play so that they can then do those things to get their needs met. And so that's why nature made play something that young animals and want to do. And it's why pleasure is wired deeply in the middle of our brains. Okay, so pleasure.
Old animals too.
Eat what?
Old animals too.
Yes. Well, hopefully we all play. Yeah. Yeah. I often thought, you know, it's a total misnomer. All these people are working out. Why do you have a workout? Why do you do a play out?
I can't remember. Never workout. Just go from work to my workout.
They all have frowns on their faces, and they have like timers. They go, "I'm gonna do this." God. Okay, so P for pleasure, E for engagement. We talked about that last time. That is, coming out of yourself is a recipe for feeling better. Staying locked in yourself is a recipe for disaster. Okay. So now we're going to talk about relationship. And then A is accomplishment, which we may or may not get to today. It will be an accomplishment if we get there. Okay, but let's talk about relationship.
What number is that?
Relationship is number 6. So relationship, okay. I guess I put something on. This is a very lame thing to put on the board, but a picture is worth 1,000 words, and in this case, it's a very rudimentary picture, but I want it to be emblazoned in your brain. Emblazoned something in your brain. That's all. point of this is as we develop, as we grow healthier, we move from a more isolated way of living to a more connected and ultimately unified way of living. If you look at it, if you look at various people, you can put them somewhere on this continuum. Neurotic people, the so-called normal neurotic, for example, is over here. No, let's start with the psychotic. A really psychotic person who's unmedicated is over here. That is, they're so locked in their own mental constructions that they really don't relate to you, or very, very poorly when they do. They're kind of in a structure of their own creating that removes them from authentic connection. So they're over here. The people that are the worst off, why people kill themselves is because they think no one cares. And typically when people are suicidal, they reach out in some way, and if somebody pays attention to them on a hotline or anywhere else, then it pulls them from that precipice. If not, if they reach out to nobody, then they're confirmed that nobody cares if I live or die, and that's unbearable for people. So this is the when people move in this direction, when we see people isolating themselves, we get worried. When we see people complaining about what's wrong with them and how bad they feel, that's good, because they're moving in this direction toward talking about it. So isolation is not a good strategy. And the ultimate of isolation is feeling completely isolated, and that's untenable. And in the psychotic, depends on the psychotic, but let's say they're over here. The normal neurotic is over here. The normal neurotic relates to you, but with a great deal of self-filter. They have a whole lot of rearview mirror. So while they're talking to you, they're thinking, does he like me? Does she like me? Am I doing a good job? Should I do this? Should I move to the left? Should I move to the right? Did I wear the right thing today? And it's all about them. And so there's hardly any attention or energy left for you. And that, you know, depending on how severe the neurosis is, it moves more in this direction, more in this direction. But the point is, those kind of people are hard to relate to because it's all about them. Maslow said that self-actualizing people differ from the rest of us, the very healthy people, in that they're less self-focused and more other-focused. He called it problem-centering versus self-centering. That is, when they talk to you, their attention is on you, not on them. And they're not thinking their own thoughts, they're listening to your thoughts. So the sense of connection increases as the health increases. What else did I want to say about that? Something crossed my mind this morning, but it'll probably float back. Another way to look at this word is love. Okay, unification means total connection, right? And love is total connection. So these are the people that feel the least loved. And the least loved. These are the people that feel at the saint stage, these are the people that are love. They're just love manifestations. There's no barrier between them and everything else. That's another way to say what happens to the self as one grows. The self, one way to say it is the self expands to take in more and more as part of who you are. Peter Singer, the famous philosopher, said moral progress throughout the ages can be measured by the circle of people whose interests you consider to be equivalent to your own. Right? So as it, you know, it's first it's me, then when you're little, then it's my family, then it's my friends, then it's my community, and many of us are at the stage of universalism. It's everything. Everybody matters. Everything matters. Okay. So that's expanding circles of compassion is what he called it. And the point is, there are some people that kind of do that completely. Let me say one more thing, which is the sense of self, in Maslow's terms, it opens. to include more and more. In other psycho-spiritual terms, it thins. So there's less barrier between you and anything else. There's more sense of interbeing. Michael?
Is awareness another expression of unification? Or does it mean?
No, it depends on what you're aware of. If the neurotic is only aware of his or her own thoughts and not aware of you at all, then that person is detached from you.
I'm thinking mostly of our meditation awareness on awareness, that kind of awareness.
If your awareness is on awareness, then it's not localized. That is, it's you're aware that you're a small part of a larger process. So yeah, it's an opening inward as opposed to an opening outward, but it's the same opening. Yeah. So anyway, why is this so? Why do we have this desire to become more connected? Well, I always go back, you know, these days you've got to go back to neuroscience and or evolutionary psychology. So evolutionary psychology says creatures that were isolated got eaten. Creatures that were connected had help to feed them, to protect them. And so we evolved into a species that functions best in bands. You know, the primate groups and the proto-human groups from which we're evolved, they were apparently bands of 20 to 30 typically. And that you read a lot of literature that says that's the way people do best now, is in groups about that size, where they can relate to everybody's individuals, but there are enough people for a critical mass. In any event, it is deep in our nature to feel better when we have adequate connection. Something I was going to say at the very end, but I might as well say it now. Why everything is getting better? Okay, we're getting better food. Around the world, conditions are getting better. We're all getting, you know, bigger houses and nicer cars and better food and better, you know. So why is it that anxiety and depression are epidemic? Why are we getting worse as we're getting better? Materially, we're getting better, and emotionally, we seem like we're getting worse. And the answer to that probably is probably a lot of answers, but the most important answer, I think, is that the way we have evolved our way of living is we pair up and we put as much wall and hedge and lawn between us and everybody else as we can, right? So what we're doing is going anti-evolutionarily, in that what we have evolved to do is want more connection, at least to a certain level. And what our affluence has given us is the opportunity to have less connection. And when you have less connection, at some deep level, it's the wrong direction. It feels wrong. It feels like you're isolated. Morton.
Doing it at the expense of others, and our awareness of that is destructive. And also your other thing is like the herd instinct. But mostly the idea that we succeed as a group, but only by sacrificing another group in order to have what we have to talk about.
Well, that's what we have to evolve to, universalism. Yeah, I'm not suggesting that we go back to tribe against tribe. But we essentially evolved to be tribal creatures. And now that tribe has been broken into smaller and smaller units. So maybe the kids would do better if they were not raised by individual couples, but there was more sense of a larger group raising those kids, like used to happen. Or maybe we would do better if we somehow lived in larger units than the atomistic kind of units we live in now. Also, to go a little further with that,
I think in the youth, you see two contradictory things happening. One thing is they're on their phones all the time. I mean, like, all the time. It's weirder and weirder and weirder. And just walk down any street and see any kid. Three quarters of the kids that you see will be actively looking at a phone at that point. I mean, the statistics are ridiculous.
The adults do that, but you might know that.
Yeah, but the kids do it, but it gets more and more and more. The kids are just completely phone creatures. And I call them homo digital, digital device.
I call them
phone
zombie.
What?
I call them phone zombie.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say it, it's like, go past it.
Yeah, but they don't hear you. No. They're zombies. So the point is that, why are they doing that? Because something deep in them wants the connection that they don't feel, and they have the connection through their phones.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, how much do they do this? I think I told you this. One student in my class a couple of semesters ago, when we talked about this, he came back the next week and he said, I clocked it. I was 36 hours on my phone last week. And he said, I'm way below the curve.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you see that, you know, 11 hours a day, the statistics are ridiculous. So the point is, they're trying to get connection. That's why they're impelled to look what he's doing, look what she's doing, look what I'm doing, look, you know, it's trying to get connection. It's just, unfortunately, that kind of connection doesn't necessarily substitute for a real person and touch and real emotion. But that the impulse is to reconnect because they feel disconnected. It's also what's behind tagging. You know, you notice what people tag. People don't tag, they don't put beautiful things, they put their name. Why do they put their name? Because it says, I'm here, I'm somebody, look at me, I'm not nobody. And they make it as big as they can and they put it as many places as they can because it says, I exist. Because people feel like they don't exist because nobody sees them. So I think what we're seeing is we're seeing a desperate attempt on the part of youth to feel okay, to feel not depressed and anxious, to feel connected.
How do you try to get connected? If I'm trying to get connected,
you go to places where then you're genuinely interested in what's happening, because then you meet people like yourself. Okay, so whatever interests you to do, whatever you think I want to learn that, I want to do that. You go there, and that's how you make friends.
Oh.
By the way, that's a general comment I make to people when they say I want to, you know, have more social connection. I say, go to the place that you really want to be, and you'll meet kindred souls there because they're going to place the same place as you are. Peg and then Michael.
Since I have a friend whose grandson grew up in London, and they Skype. They Skype reading, they Skype the first words, they Skype the first steps. He came and saw her, and he goes, you're supposed to be on the computer.
What can I tell you? It's a simulacrum of real life, unfortunately. And it has certain, it lacks certain things. Michael.
I think connecting through the technology has something to do with safety also and fear, because I've seen at restaurants or wherever where you have a group of young people at the same table who know each other, and three quarters of them are on the phone. I've seen them text each other.
Yeah, that's a party. You sit around together because you've got to be together, and you all do your phone because it's safer that way. Absolutely, you can edit. That's what, you know, Sherry, if you haven't seen Sherry Turkle's TED Talk, Alone Together, you got to see that talk. I mean, she says it better than anybody. She says, you know, that there's more and more connection, there's more and more isolation at the same time, because it's not genuine, human, risky, face-to-face, emotional stuff. It's all edited, you know? It's all putting a show up. Sarah, and then we're going to move on.
I've been observing my family. I have a very large family, 5 adult children and lots of grandchildren and so on. I've been observing them for the last, probably most of the years I've been here in this class. Obviously, I'm also observing myself. My youngest son, who is probably the most clear of all of them, he tells me fairly often how he wishes that he could buy a big piece of property and help the whole family build houses on that property so that they would all be there.
Yeah.
And I hear him saying pretty much what you have been saying in the last 10 minutes. He wants to join up with the family that he was with when he was little, and our family had no extended family at all that we could be connected with. And while observing him and our family through him, I'm also observing the daughter who married into a family that was big connected, major long distance family and all local family, and nobody would leave Southern California, no matter what job offered him a lot more money, because they wanted that extended family thing to be there. And so as you were talking about this, I'm going, oh yeah, look at Richard. Oh yeah, look at Jane. That's what they're doing. And we don't, and I grew up without an extended family also. And so I'm now gonna start paying attention and see what is that meaning to us as a family. What are we not or definitely doing?
As an elder in that family, you have a responsibility to try to bring that connection back, or to make that connection. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to move on. So something that Sarah said that. Okay. A couple of things from research, and then I want to go to the major thing I want to talk about. Okay. So first of all, you can see this need for connection in infants, in very, very, very young children. Andrew Melzack has done a famous series of studies where he makes faces at newborns, and they make faces back. Okay, that is, they're capable at an extremely early age, I don't know what age, but really early, of sticking their tongue out, of opening their eyes, of doing whatever he does, and he has films of it, you can actually see it on YouTube, of him making faces at the kids and the kids imitating back. This is due to mirror neurons in the brain, which immediately connect the kids. So they're from day zero, they're able to make connection by imitation. And then the second thing is, another group of researchers did this amazing study with 1 hour old kids who have very, very bad vision, by the way. They don't have good vision for months, but good enough so that what they did is they took circles and they passed them in front of the young kids, of the incredibly newborn's eyes. And two circles that they passed are, one looked like this, and the other looked like and the newborns, see, so this circle or this circle, the newborns stared way longer at this circle than this circle. At zero age, we are prepared when we come into the world to respond to faces, as opposed to equivalently complicated discs, which are less like faces. So the point is, we're tuned from age zero to connect. Because I've talked about this before, I'll be fairly brief about talking about it, but the question is, how does this need for connection that we're born with, how does this play out in terms of how connected we are throughout our lives? And the answer to that seems to lie in what happens to us very early in our lives. The patterns that we adopt very early in our lives are then the patterns that we play out for the rest of our lives. And this, as many of you know, is called attachment research. The question is, what attachment style do we experience when we're newborn and very young? And how does that attachment style then pattern the way we deal with other people for the rest of our lives? So because I've talked about this before, I'm going to be very brief about it, but I do want to treat it. Where does this work come from? In 1950, the World Health Organization hired a British psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist named John Bowlby, who knew about the work of Konrad Lorenz in the 1930s having to do with critical periods and imprinting. Lorenz was the farmer who, when the geese, newborn goslings saw him, imprinted to him, because newborn geese will imprint to the first moving thing they see, and followed him around like mama for the rest of their lives. Okay, so he was mama because he was the first thing. So Lorenz talked about critical periods in development, very early in development, and imprinting during those critical periods. And we apparently have something like that. So Bowlby knew about this work. So he was hired by the World Health Organization in 1950 to report on the health of kids that had been orphaned by World War II. Kids at this age who were 5 to 18. So the war ended in 45. Some of these kids were just born when the war was ending. Other of these kids were born before the war, but their parents were killed in the war, or one of the parents was killed in the war, and then the other parent couldn't take care of the kids. So these kids ended up in orphanages. And Bowlby especially studied British orphanages. What everybody expected was that the kids would be doing very well, because these are, after all, British orphanages. They're very well run, they have very good staff, they have very good food, they have very good facilities. Everybody figured these kids got great custodial care, they did great. They actually did really badly. The older kids were getting in trouble, typically for thievery and misbehavior at school. The younger kids were doing bizarre things like banging their heads and rocking, and some of the youngest kids actually died for no reason anybody could figure out. So Bowlby wrote this up, and it created a maelstrom of concern, because institutions all around the world were run this way. And Bowlby said, what kids need in order to be okay is, quote, a warm and continuous relationship with at least one adult caregiver. A warm and continuous relationship with at least one adult caregiver. And in these institutions, the staff was always changing. Every 8 hours, new staff, people would transfer away. So the kids got great care, but they didn't get a warm and continuous relationship with at least one adult caregiver. So this changed the way that we institutionalize people in hospitals and in orphanages and other such places. But it was not without a lot of controversy when he started to talk about this.
What's the name of the guy, Bowlby?
Bowlby, John Bowlby. And he wrote three large volumes about this in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, which I haven't read and I never will. But you're welcome to. In any event, this caused, in the 1960s, a woman named Mary Ainsworth at Johns Hopkins University to try to study this more formally in the laboratory. By the way, I just want to know, how many of you are bored by this because you've heard me say this so many times? Once before, is it okay to be going through this?
Yeah.
Right. It's good review anyway. All right, so Mary Ainsworth in the 1960s brought one-year-old children and their mamas into her laboratory at Johns Hopkins. And the laboratory was set up like a playroom with a couple of chairs and some really cool toys and a one-way mirror so Ainsworth and her staff could look at what happened. So what happens is the one-year-old and the mama come in, mama sits down, and then they watch to see if the one-year-old goes to play with the toys or stays with mama or looks back at mama while he or she plays with the toys. And then a stranger comes in, talks to mama, sits down next to mama. They see what the kid does. Then mama leaves and they see what the kid does. The stranger tries to play with the kid. They see what the kid does. Then mama comes back. They see what the kid does. And that's the basic paradigm, although they changed it slightly from time to time. But that's the basic deal. They were looking to see what the kid does in these situations, called the strange situation test. So Ainsworth found out that kids fell into three broad categories. Now, kids don't fall exactly into this category, this category, this category. But these are ways of kind of characterizing three patterns that she saw. About 60% of kids fell into the category called secure attachment. Those kids, when they came into the laboratory, they stayed with mama for a little while, then they went to play with the toys, looking back at mama, making contact with mama, verbalizing to mama, but playing with the toys. Then when the stranger came in, they weren't disturbed by that. They kept playing with the toys, looked back at mama. Then when mama left, they cried. They got disturbed. And then when the stranger came up to play with them, they could sort of get comforted, but they weren't entirely comforted. Then when Mama came back, they went back to Mama, hugged Mama, were comforted, felt better, went back to playing with the toys. Secure attachment. These are kids that could count on Mama's attention, that Mama was a safe base, they could explore from the base of Mama. So that's about 60%, about 3 out of every 5 kids. About 25% of kids fell into category 2. That is, when they came in and they sat down, then the kids immediately went to play with the toys. They did not look back at Mama. And when the stranger came in, nothing in particular. When Mama left, they were not upset at all. They kept playing with the toys. When the stranger came up to play with them, they played with the stranger just perfectly okay. When Mama came back, they ignored her. They kept playing with the toys. This is about a quarter of kids at 1 year old, 25%. This is called avoidant attachment. I'm going to tell you why this happens, but I got to do the 3 categories. Oh,
okay.
So that's avoidant. Then about 15% of kids fell into the third category. They came in, the child and the mama came in, the child stayed with the mama, clung to the mama, did not go to play with the toys, maybe eventually went to play with the toys. When the stranger came in, the child, I don't know what the child did in that case, but when Mama left, the child was incredibly upset. When the stranger tried to play with the child, the child stayed really upset. When Mama came back, the child rushed up to Mama, grabbed her for dear life, was crying, really upset, and at the same time looked angry and turned away. It was like had conflicted feelings. Both clinging, and then didn't go back to play with the toys, stayed crying, playing with Mama. I mean, not playing with Mama, but clinging to Mama. So these kids were what's called, you see it different ways, ambivalent or anxious, or anxious ambivalent. So let's call them ambivalent. Okay. So anxious or anxious ambivalent or ambivalent. Okay. So this is about 15% of kids. A later researcher named Mary Main, M-A-I-N, found that some of the kids didn't fit neatly into either avoidant or ambivalent, but were kind of a mix. She called them disorganized. Disorganized something else. She said some of the kids fit into that category. So the 40% that weren't securely attached were in 3 different categories. This one, or a mixture. But I'm going to leave that out. Okay. I'm just going to talk about Ainsworth work. So the question is, what kind of parenting would make at 1 year old kids have these different bonding things happening? A mama that was there and was attentive created a securely attached kid. A mama who was not attentive, was either not there or narcissistic and didn't really pay any attention to the kid, or was all the time off with boyfriends or whatever, or was drunk all the time, or was the kid was raised by a succession of nannies because mama didn't really know how to be a mama. That kid realized that she or he was going to have to be self-contained, because you weren't going to get the love from outside. So that kid became I take care of myself kid. And it didn't matter whether mama left or not, because there was no real bond. This is already 1 year old, and about a quarter of kids are white. Okay. And then the ambivalent kids, they had mothering where they got the love, but then the love was withdrawn occasionally. Mother wasn't there for one reason or another. She was away at work or something, or she was drunk, or she had love sometimes, and then she shut it off sometimes for various reasons. So these are kids that know how precious love is, but know that it's going to be taken away, so they hold on to it for dear life. Okay? And at the same time, they're angry that it's going to be taken away. So how does this relate to you and me? I'm going to read 3 paragraphs. I'm going to read 3 paragraphs to you. If I can find them. There we go. I'm going to read each paragraph twice. Which one of these paragraphs most is who you are? Okay. Oh, this is the work of Cindy Hazen and Philip Shaver in the 1980s, because Cindy Hazen and Philip Shaver realized that this patterning that had happened very early in life was not just about what's going to happen very early in life. This is the prototype that one then displays throughout life when it comes to relating to other people. This is the basic pattern that you learn early that you then are patterned as. So here are three paragraphs. You decide which one is most like you. If there's one that's most like you, but there's another one that's somewhat like you, you can kind of vote for mostly this one, but somewhat that one. Here we go. One, I find it relatively easy to get close to other people. I'm comfortable depending on other people and having them depend on me. I don't usually worry about being abandoned by others or about having someone get too close to me. Again, I find it relatively easy to get close to other people. I am comfortable depending on other people and having them depend on me. I don't usually worry about being abandoned or about having someone get too close to me. Paragraph one. Paragraph two. I find it difficult to trust people completely. I'm somewhat uncomfortable being close to other people. I feel nervous when people start to get too close to me. Often, I feel like people want me to be more intimate than I feel comfortable being. I find it difficult to allow myself to depend on other people. Two, I find it difficult to trust other people completely. I'm somewhat uncomfortable being close to other people. I feel nervous when people start to get too close to me. Often, I feel like people want me to be more intimate than I feel comfortable being. I find it difficult to allow myself to depend on other people. Paragraph three. I find that other people are reluctant to get as close to me as I would like. I often worry that someone I'm close to doesn't really love me or won't want to stay with me. I want to merge completely with another person, and this sometimes scares people away. So, I find that other people are reluctant to get as close to me as I would like. I often worry that someone I'm close to doesn't really love me or won't want to stay with me. I want to merge completely with another person, and this sometimes scares people away. So it turns out that about 55% of adults mostly identify with paragraph one. About 25% of adults mostly identify with paragraph two, and about 20% of adults mostly identify with paragraph three. So the question is, which one do you mostly identify with, and is there another undertone? So, what's this all about? Secure attachment, avoidant attachment, anxious ambivalent attachment. Let's make it more graphic. I'm going to introduce you, I'm going to bring into our classroom several couples, and we're going to have them sit on the couch here so we can meet them. Come on in, folks. Sit down. If the two people in the romantic couple sit down next to one another on the couch, maybe not touching, maybe a couple of inches apart, but sit down next to one another, these are two people who have their own space and who are yet connected as a unit. They're me and we. This is a secure couple. Let's bring another couple in. They sit down, and first they sit down like the first couple, and then one person scoots over this way. Feels more comfortable. I gotta have my space. This is a couple, one of whom is avoidant. Keeps moving away. Feel better this way. Now let's bring another couple in. They sit down, and one member of the couple says, "Can I sit on your lap?" To become one. You know?
Let's bring another couple in, a very typical couple, unfortunately. And this happens, in those of you who do therapy, this happens, you can see, if you do couples therapy, it happens all the time. Sit down. One of them goes like this, and then the other one goes like this, and one goes like this. That's your typical avoidant chased by an ambivalent. Okay? This is funny, but it's also really sobering, because unless you realize this patterning, it's what happens to you throughout your life in regard to being close to other people. So what do you do about this? Unfortunately, I taught this last night, and one guy, very bright guy, said, well, isn't it enough to know about it? And I said, no. Mm-hmm. It's necessary, but it's a sufficient, but it's a necessary but not a sufficient condition. That is, you have to know about it. You have to realize that the reason your relationships are not going well is because of something that you are bringing to the relationship, because it's not all their fault, you know? So you have to kind of get self-aware about what your patterning is. But that will change your patterning. You can't intellectually change your patterning. The patterning can only be changed in actual relationship, because it's about relationship. And it's going to be hard to do emotionally. So after you realize what your pattern is, if it's not a healthy pattern, then you have to go into a relationship where the pattern can be recast. And typically that's done in therapy. Therapists are very good at this. This is a passion of anybody that's an MFT or that does any of this work. I mean, this is what we know about. Okay? So the point is, you can go into therapy, but with someone that knows about this. And typically what will happen is, if you're avoidant, when you start to get into the heavy stuff, you know, the difficult stuff, you'll call up and say, I can't make it next Tuesday. And your therapist will say, excuse me, we have a date next Tuesday at 4:00, you be here. That is, she or he will repattern you from your avoidant. He or she will say, look, I'm not gonna eat you, you're not gonna die in the session, come, you belong, okay. So. The therapist will show you how to be in a relationship in a secure way. And that'll take time, and that's a tough thing to do, but therapists are good at it. If you're anxious ambivalent, you'll call your therapist up every morning. Oh, guess what I just learned today? Oh, you wouldn't believe it, you're such a great therapist. The therapist will say, excuse me, we have an appointment next Tuesday at 4:00. Save it for them. Write it in your journal. So your therapist can slowly and painfully show you how to relate in a different way. And because the relationship with the therapist is so important, it's a significant relationship, and it really does recast the patterning. If you can't or don't want to do this with a therapist, there's one other possibility. If you have a secure partner, and you are not an entirely securely attached person, then that partner can reparent you. You will put them through hell. but it can be done. If they love you enough, when you create distance, they'll say, look, I'm not going to eat you. You belong with me now. I don't care that you want to be, please, that's our deal. You know, we're going to do this together. Come back. You know, come sit up by me. It'll be okay. Or when you, every 15 minutes, when your partner phones you and says, where are you? Who are you with? What are you doing? Look, excuse me, I'll be home at 6:00 tonight. I love you. I'm not going to abandon you. But don't call me every 15 minutes. A secure partner can repattern a not so secure partner. But again, it's going to be a difficult process. When people say, okay, what about? I understand that I'm a not healthy pattern. Why don't I choose, and the people I'm choosing are not good for me, why don't I just choose somebody else? So the therapist the therapist says, why don't you choose somebody else? She did the work only with mothers and children, but it also has to do with fathers and children. So let's say you're in therapy, and you're in therapy because you're a female, and your last three relationships that you thought were going to be marriage and love forever have blown up in your face. And your therapist says to you, do you see any pattern in this, what happened here? And you go, no. And so your
therapist says, tell me about your father. And you say, oh, I love my father. My father loved me. It was what, you know, was your father emotionally available to you? What do you mean? Did your father tell you he loved you? Did he spend time with you? Did he share experiences with you? No, he was at work all the time. But I knew he loved me. Did he ever say he loved you? Well, yeah, once or twice, I think. Did you try to get him to say, I love you? Oh, all the time. Did he ever come through and give you the, well, no, but I know he loved me. Okay, now let's talk about your three partners. Were they emotionally available? You mean like my father? You mean not like my father? No. They were like, did they say they love you? No, but I knew. Light goes off. Oh my God, they're just like my dad. Okay. So now the person realizes that same pattern that was in childhood is a pattern that I'm deploying now. So then the therapist says, well, how about finding somebody who's emotionally available to relate to? Mm-hmm. And then you try to do that and you say, I'm not interested in that person. That person's boring. Because the pattern from childhood has been, you get imprinted on this pattern. It was an unhealthy pattern. And so a new pattern is going to be initially uncomfortable. So now I'm going to say something that Jack Canfield said. I know a lot of you have very mixed feelings about some of the things he said, but one of the very clever things he said, which we'll do right now, is interlace your hands. Interlace your hands like this. Okay? Which thumb is on top? Okay, some are right, some are left. Now re-interlace your hands with the other thumb on top. Okay? That was of all the things he said, that's the only one I'm gonna take from that lecture. But anyway, it's uncomfortable, right? It's hard to do. So when you're learning a new emotional pattern, especially one deep in you, it's gonna be hard. It's not gonna feel familiar. You're gonna want to go back to the old way. But with enough therapeutic support or support from other people, you can repattern yourself. You can realize that there's a healthier kind of relationship, even if it isn't so familiar to you initially, even if it isn't so comfortable in you initially. Okay. So what do you want to say about, what do you want to ask or say about this patterning stuff? And what I just said about attachment. Anything you, okay, Catherine.
Growing up with a fraternal twin sister, there was this attachment and isolation. She was given all the love and attention, and she was very clingy to mother. And even when mother passed on, she just was an emotional mess, can't even talk about mother anymore. And with me, I was kind of pushed aside to do my own thing. No affection, it was always condemning. Always. There was never any love. I was never told I was loved. And it was always discipline. Always discipline with me. And so I learned to be very independent and isolated at a very young age. I can remember when I think we were about 3, my mom had to go to work and the neighbor took care of us. My twin sister would be standing there sobbing and I'd be waving goodbye. Didn't bother me, and if she didn't come back, I really didn't care. You know?
So you learned to be avoidant, and she learned to be ambivalent.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. So Morty and then Chris.
See, but my inclination, if I were closer to her, I would take my hugger right now.
I mean, it's so obvious, Morty, that you were raised in a family where there was a lot of love, and it was demonstrated.
The only time I misbehaved was in the lower classes because I was in love with the teacher, and my punishment was she would put me under her desk as close to her as I could be, sitting and looking at all my friends, saying, "Look at me,
I'm with the teacher." So that explains Morty's misbehaviors at present. So Chris.
So how do we explain people that escape the pattern even though they're subject to it? I'm thinking of Amma, you know, the Indian woman who was rejected by her parents as of age six and put it to service because her skin was too dark and it embarrassed the family. Her brother tried to kill her, and she developed into this highly compassionate being.
Sometimes there's grace, I guess. And people make a connection with something larger than themselves. So that there's something beyond the personality that recasts the personality. So I guess there's a third possibility, which is a secure partner, a therapist, or some spiritual opening.
Spiritual.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see. We know here and here and here. Okay.
Just real quick, what did Wayne Dyer, wasn't he an orphan?
Wayne Dyer,
wasn't he an orphan?
No, he was put into an orphanage when his mother couldn't take care of him.
Yes.
She took them back after many years.
Oh, okay. So,
okay. Gloria, and then Michael will go here. Go ahead.
Something interesting that occurred to me was for years now I've been trying to look at my parents' point of view. Yeah. Me as a kid, and think about it, when they bring their first kid home from the hospital, they are as happy as can be. It's, I'm talking about some, you know, let's say some percentage, and they tell all their friends and they have everyone over and everyone's kissing and hugging the baby, but there's no way mom and dad can be with them every second of every day. Especially if they have other kids. So it occurred to me that what we interpret as them not paying enough attention or loving us enough, I mean, to me it points to the idea of having the big group raise kids, because nobody can get the attention 100% of the time from mom and dad.
Right, so the question is, what two things. What percentage of the time do you get it? As our lives become more preoccupied, then the kids get it less and less, unfortunately. But I want to talk about the parents for a little bit, because I think part of the process of healing your own wounds in this regard is having compassion for your parents, forgiving your parents. Because they did the best job they could, but they had their own stuff, and they, you know, and they didn't have the benefit of all the stuff that we know now. So, if you can love them as best you can, flawed though they were, it opens your heart, and when it opens your heart, it opens your heart to be able to love better generally. But if you hold these resentments, then you're holding up, you're closing your heart, and that closes your ability to love, period. So you kind of have to understand where they came from, and that they did the best they could, and that they were probably pretty distressed about some of the things that they did, just like any parent is distressed about what he or she occasionally says that was said to him or her when you were little, and you go, how could that come out of my mouth, given what I felt about it when I was little, but, you know, so...
My dad worked three jobs.
To
take care of.
Yeah, so that's how they knew to do, is you gotta provide. But there wasn't sometimes a realization that there's another kind of provenance that you have to provide.
Yeah, because the memory of my mom is she was always doing laundry. As bad as she was to us, and they were doing the best.
They were doing what they had learned to do, the best they could. Okay, so we're going this way. Okay, one, two, three.
The latest version of the Ainsworth attachment questionnaire is available online, free, with some analysis tools afterwards, if you want to check.
Yeah, it's called the Adult Attachment Interview, or the Adult Attachment Questionnaire, and it's Shaver and Hazen at this point, I think, or somebody maybe even more recent. But yeah, the Adult Attachment Interview is a longer version of what I gave you, Robert.
Yeah, we have an interesting political situation in this country where the divide is between rural and urban more than regions of country now. I know people realize that. So, and that is very much related to all these issues that we're talking about. The rural mindset is just let me be far away from other people, and my connections will be through the church. And the urban mindset is secular connections through shared interests. And just the fact that you're walking and using public transit, the rural mindset is, I want to get in my car and I don't want to have to interact with anybody else except for that hour on Sunday in church where it's just my church people. As Martin Luther King said, that's the most segregated hour of the week. So I'm not saying what the answer is, but I think the start is to just be aware that there's these two very different ways of seeing things, and I don't know, we need to start by just recognizing.
Yeah. I recognize it because I have a my sister, like the same thing as what you said. You know, want to be with their own people and all that.
So let me say one more thing, which is there are two kind of contradictory impulses in us, which go back to the two scenarios that Robert painted. We were all collectivists, you know, we evolved to live in groups, okay? And our identity was always a collectivist identity. We always considered ourselves part of the group. It was always about we. What you did in your extended family or your tribal group was promote the welfare of the whole group. E.O. Wilson at Harvard talks about the fact that it isn't the selfish gene, it's the group's genes, that it's group survival that evolution wants. That is, so your self-definition was as a part of this group, and your concern was for the welfare of the group. That was the way human beings have been raised or have evolved. But in the last several thousand years, there's come a seemingly contradictory trajectory, which is the trajectory of individualism, right? It's not about my group, it's about me. And it's about my happiness, and it's about my fulfillment. So even though most of the world remains collectivist, America and Northern Europe, and now because the media is streaming all over the world, more and more people all over the world are considering themselves a me, not a we, and are acting based on what's good for them, not necessarily what's good for their family or the group they identify with. And so these two patterns of individuation and collective concern can sometimes seem like they're opposite patterns, pulling in opposite directions. But what seems to be the healthy strategy is to have both patterns strong in the self and to have them somehow cooperate so that you take care of yourself and you make a happy life for yourself, but you also are concerned for the people around you and the community that you're in and the world. So you retain a collectivism that is in your genetic nature, and you adopt the individualism that cultural evolution has brought to human life. Carl.
Yeah, there's another trend that you didn't emphasize, you might mention briefly, but the trend for the last 10,000 years after agriculture was to create enormous collectives, and started in the Middle East and Egypt, and now it's spread around the world. And I think a lot of rebellion, a lot of chaos has come from the formation of these enormous collectives that are very insecure against the disaster, you know, yeah. Food shortages, floods, and that's what drives a lot of people's insecurity.
Yeah. So
the collectives are no longer the size of our bands, you know, 20 people, they're now 20 million, and the whole thing is quite unstable.
And you can look at these very modern perturbations as because the band gave way to the enormous agricultural city connected thing, the hyper collective, then out of that as a reaction rose rampant individualism to counteract that loss of identity in the huge collective.
Those are the two extremes.
Yeah, so those are the two extremes. That's well said, Carl.
And what we're trying to find now is a way to kind of come back to a sense of connectedness, but also a sense of individual integrity and the individual life. And that's why, you know, that's why the hippies did that go back to the farm thing, and why the Israelis did the kibbutz, and, you know, there are various, and there have always been these utopian ideas, which always have to do with a limited number of people living in a cooperative way. Chris?
Yeah, there's a new trend. I think there's a self-correcting process that happens when we go extreme. The reaction to isolation and consumerism is the birth online of pay nothing, where people just give things for free, whether it's services or goods, but they also develop relationships in the process. So there's I think there's a self-correcting happening when we go astray.
There always has to be, because deep in our nature there's a feeling of what is good for us. And so it's always going to be an expression of that deep understanding. An example of this is the neighborhood associations that are springing up online, where people not only kind of, did you see that? Be careful of this. I have this for the giveaway. But it also unites the people in neighborhoods in cooperative groups that know one another. Because anonymity is, the anonymity of living in a city is killing. So more to you, then we gotta go.
But the powers that be, you know, the way to keep that power is divide and conquer. So when Trump says this guy and that guy and this guy and that guy, to individualize you, that works against you, and that's a strategy that's used to gain the power that he has.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that if you can identify an enemy, then you can consolidate power on your side. So, Ken. Okay. All right. So we're done. We're done for this week. When we come back next week, we'll talk about accomplishment, and I will show you the video that I should have shown you today.